This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. Stay tuned, and we have a guest on today and a couple of announcements. It'll be a good show. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight. Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is under the earth. I know you don't know what life is really worth. It's a cord that Peter is cold. After story had never been told. So now you see the light. And this is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. A couple of announcements before we get to our guest today. Next week on Occupied Territory, which is on every, if you're new, it's on every week at 2 p.m. on Thursdays at 2 p.m. Eastern. And, of course, there are podcasts available later the same day or the next day. If you like the show, please tell everybody about it. Also, you can go to our Facebook page called Occupied Territory, and you can make comments on the show. You can see other essays that I write. Usually I write them daily these days. You can respond. So go to Occupied Territory, the Facebook page, and let us know what you think of anything you hear on here and let other people know about it. When you go there, if you want to, you can like the page. All right. So next Thursday, Greg Palast will be on. And Greg Palast, most of you are familiar with him. He's a stellar investigative journalist. And he had somewhat of a relationship as a journalist and possibly even an advisor in some ways to Hugo Chavez. And he met him a few times and has written extensively about him. There's an article I posted by Palast on Hugo Chavez on Occupied Territory, which you can check out if you want to go there anytime. That'll be next Thursday at 11 a.m. Also, I've mentioned this before, but one of the best sites on the Internet to get information that really is true and necessary to hear about, and they have very good writers on their staff, and they have some guest essayists, is a place called Common Dreams. And like every place else like this, because they're trying to do something real in the world and not something to make a lot of money or to go along with what they're told to do, they're always on the verge of being broke. And Common Dreams should not go dark. This is one website that should not go dark. It's a great place, Common Dreams. And so go to Common Dreams, just you know, find it on the Internet, and see if you can give them $5 or $10 or something. And they really need the money. Okay, so you see what Mr. Obama is doing recently. He is appointing, obviously, you know, he's starting his new term. He's appointing new heads. A lot of people are leaving his administration and going back into the business world where they came from and where they always were anyhow, even though they had these titles as secretary of this and secretary of that. So he needs new business people to pretend that they're going to be the secretary of energy and, you know, the head of the SEC or the treasury secretary, whatever it is. And one of the people that he's wants to appoint, well, it looks like he wants to appoint for the for the Department of Energy, is somebody who has been in the past not necessarily a cheerleader, but perhaps, but somebody who is very, very intensely in favor of fracking. And we're going to talk to somebody today who knows about this and also generally the state of water in the country. And that's Emily Wirth. And is it Food and Water Watch, Emily?
Yes, Food and Water Watch.
Okay, Food and Water Watch on the net. And Emily Wirth is with us. And the appointment of somebody, and his name is Ernest Moniz, M-O-N-I-Z, and he's an MIT professor. And according to the article on Common Dreams that I read, he is known for championing gas fracking. And he wasn't he the head of a group or a study that pretended to study all this or to study all this and said that fracking really, if managed right, wouldn't be a problem?
Yeah, so Dr. Moniz has served as the director of MIT's Energy Initiative that, you know, includes the members who are major oil and gas companies, including Shell and BP Technology Ventures and Saudi Aramco, as well as a number of other oil and gas companies. And so it's really problematic because, you know, he's been now for years doing research that's funded by the industry, who has clearly a vested interest in what the findings of that research are. And so a lot of the research has supported, you know, using gas as a quote-unquote bridge fuel. And, you know, for the most part, gas is only extracted by using hydraulic fracturing. I think it's 90% now of all drilling and fracking. Drilling requires fracking to get the gas to come to the surface.
Now, it's, I mean, something like this, of course, in an ideal world, in a decent world, would be so questionable as to be, you know, as to immediately cause him to be rejected. But since we're dealing with a completely capitalist organization here, the current administration, I mean, if you look at the other people like Mary Jo White, you know, at the SEC, and, you know, Jacob Lew for Treasury Secretary, he's just appointing all these people who are part of the problem, not part of the solution. So, when he goes in front of, he has not been appointed. We don't know if he's actually been picked and appointed, and we'll go through the hearing process, right?
Well, on Monday, President Obama did hold a press conference that indicated that, yes, this is who he's putting forward for Energy Secretary. He has to go through the nominating hearings at this point, you know, go through the congressional nomination hearings. But Obama has officially announced it. For many weeks, it was just rumored. The media had caught wind of the fact that this was one of the front runners. But that was confirmed on Monday when President Obama held a press conference and announced him.
So when he goes in front of the, I mean, we see what happens when people like Brennan or Mary Jo White or these people go in front of these committees. One or two hard questions are asked, and mostly they're just, you know, they're sort of all kissing them and saying, we're so happy that you're going to do this. Do you expect any kind of intelligent or harsh questioning of his backing by the same people that he's supposed to be studying?
I hope so. I mean, there are several very important decisions that would be coming in front of whomever becomes the Secretary of Energy. One that we've been tracking here at Food and Water Watch is the decision that the Department of Energy has to make about whether or not it's in the United States' interest to export liquefied natural gas overseas. So for years, we had a shortage of gas, and a lot of terminals had been set up on the coast to import gas to try to meet demand. But with a combination of new technologies that the oil and gas industry has used, which has kind of come under this one, you know, catch-all phrase, fracking, there's now a glut of gas in the U.S. And what this has done is caused gas prices to drop really low to a point where it's really not profitable for the industry to continue using this really intensive extractive process that's energy intensive and really costly for the industry. And so what they would like to do is get the terminals and other, they have other proposals to get terminals built to export U.S. natural gas overseas to Asia and Europe where they can get a higher price for it. Mm. And so the Department of Energy is about to make a decision about whether or not this is in the public interest of the United States. And this is a very critical decision because if it's approved, up to 40% of current consumption could be exported overseas. And what that will lead to is much more drilling and fracking in U.S. communities where we're growing increasingly aware of what the impacts are for the health and well-being, the natural resources, and even the economies of local communities. And so at Food and Water Watch, we oppose this. We do not think it's in the interest of the American people. It might be in the interest of, you know, the wealthy oil and gas companies and their, you know, their executives, but most Americans would not benefit and would actually see their own gas prices go up from this. And then, like I said, they'll bear the cost from this extractive process and the effects of that over the long term for their communities.
Maybe, you know, I think most people who listen to this show and most people in general these days who pay attention to these things understand hydraulic fracturing, but maybe you could explain it, because one thing I think people understand what the problems are, but I don't think anybody has even the slightest conception, or sometimes you see these things, how much water is involved, where this water comes from, whose water it is, and what it does to water eventually, that when it's used, when they're through with it.
Yeah, so this is a process, and like I said, it's a combination of different technologies that developed over the past decade that have allowed gas and now oil to be extracted from dense rock formations. And so what's done is a well is drilled up to 1 to 2 miles or underground. So and there's a thin, tight rock layer. This is specifically talking about shale, which you've heard a lot in this area. The Marcellus Shale is the one in Pennsylvania and New York, and there's also the Utica Shale. But the Marcellus Shale is where a lot of fracking is taking place in Pennsylvania and where the industry would like to do this in New York. But anyway, you drill down, and then you inject millions of gallons. It's, it ranges from 1 to 8 million gallons per frack job, depending on the geology of the area, and that's combined with sand and hundreds of different chemicals have been used in this process, many of which are known to be toxic. And it's injected, you know, at high pressure underground, breaks apart the rock, the sand props open the cracks, and the gas is released out through the well. Now, this is sending this water way underground, and somewhere between 25 to 70% of it flows back up to the surface. So when it comes back up to the surface, it contains not only the chemicals that were put into the water by the industry, but also other things that come up from underground, including heavy metals, salts, and radioactive material. So then you've got this wastewater that has to be disposed of somehow, and there's really no safe way to dispose of this. So not only did some of the water stay underground where it was forever outside of the water cycle, it doesn't ever, it's way in the Earth's crust, basically. Mm-hmm. We've also contaminated the rest of the water, and then it's either trucked out and then injected underground in injection wells in Ohio, or in some places it has been sent to facilities that weren't really equipped to deal with all the contaminants in it, and that's caused a number of problems too. But at Food and Water Watch, we're really concerned. I mean, this is happening in parts of the country like Colorado and Texas where we're already facing severe drought. And so we should not be using, the country's limited freshwater resources in this way.
You know, what you're going to hear from the other side is it's providing a lot of, I'm just going to recite this, right, because you hear this all the time. It'll provide a lot of jobs. Like, for instance, the terminals to export the gas, the actual drilling, what's involved there, the trucks, you know, that carry the sand back and forth. All of this kind of stuff involves probably thousands of jobs. So somebody will tell you that. Then, of course, there's the individual stories you hear of farmers in upstate New York or ranchers or people who have been, you know, who can't make a living anymore. And then really they're sort of going out of business, either the drought in one place or prices in another place or whatever. And somebody comes along and says, and they have families, right? And somebody comes along and says, we're not buying your land, but we want to lease it or part of your land. And here's $1 million. I mean, these are the things that people say, right? So I'd be interested in your response to all that.
Well, for the first issue, I think that what people should know is that the jobs go to a set of highly trained workers who know how to do this. And so they move around the country, and they actually, like North Dakota is seeing this right now because the industry is moving towards oil away from natural gas because the price of gas is so low temporarily. And then once they get the exports approved, they'll go back to fracking for gas. But they set up these camps, basically, where the workers from Texas and Oklahoma and where this was originally developed and where they've done most of the fracking and drilling, now they move the workers to the other parts of the country. So for the most part, these are very these are transient workers who are coming into the communities and taking most of the jobs, and the other jobs are short term. And so I think the way we see it, we need to generate much more sustainable and long term economic growth in these areas. And renewable energy is actually a really great way to do that. And the oil and gas industry has worked really hard to keep decision makers and the American public from believing that renewable energy is possible. But it is, and it just needs the backing of our elected officials to invest and make the deployment of renewable energy a priority for our health and for our economy and for the future generations.
Is when Mr. Obama stands up at the State of the Union or whatever, you know, inauguration, any of these speeches, and he says just enough for liberals who don't really want to get bothered too much to say, oh, yeah, he said alternative energy. I feel better now. Mm-hmm. There was a decision just the other day about the pipeline, right? I mean, really, what is he actually saying and what is he actually doing? I don't see any connection here at all. He mentions alternative energy and then he approves this and approves that, you know.
I think he's contradicting himself right now with what he's saying about energy and climate change. You know, it was very encouraging to hear him finally mention climate change in his inaugural address and in his State of the Union address. But this mantra that the all-of-the-above energy strategy is going to be enough to prevent catastrophic climate change is false. And so what we need to do is continue to pressure him to make the tough decisions, because we simply cannot continue to try to use these intensive extraction techniques and get every last drop of oil and gas from our country and from the world and expect to avoid catastrophic climate change. We're already seeing the effects of it, and we know that what we need to do is dramatically decrease the use of fossil fuels and aggressively deploy renewable energy. And so I know all the climate scientists are warning of that. And so this all-of-the-above energy strategy will not help climate change. It needs to be opposed aggressively.
When you say opposed aggressively, this show is based on partially on the premise that the vote is really not very useful anymore. You know, I mean, in other words, you got two major parties, both of whom are in the pockets of these energy mm-hmm. companies, and certainly the president is, as far as I can tell, you know, donations and the party itself. So when you say opposed, what exactly do you mean by opposed, so that regular people listening mm-hmm. that it would actually make a difference? Because I don't see my vote making any difference.
Well, I think that there is a growing movement, definitely against hydrofracking, and you see that in New York. I mean, it's one of the most incredible grassroots movements in recent history and has effectively continued to prevent fracking from coming to New York State. We just recently got, you know, won another delay in New York. And so join the organizations in the state. There are grassroots groups all across the state. There are hundreds of them in New York State, so there's got to be one in your community.
There's a growing
movement against climate change, and I was one of the 50,000 people that marched in D.C., and that got tons of media attention and educated the public. So I think we just really have to go back to the kind of organizing campaigns that have worked in the past and that we know can make a difference.
Hey, you're listening to Emily Wirth, who is Food and Water Watch's Water Program Director. Can you tell us about Food and Water Watch?
Sure. Food and Water Watch is a consumer organization working to safeguard our food and water resources. We work at the local, state, and federal level on issues. We do a lot of research, so you should check out our website, foodandwaterwatch.org. There's a lot of really helpful information there. And we also are constantly, taking on campaigns and sending emails, so you can sign up on our email list and find ways to take action. And like I said, at the local, state, and federal level, we work a lot on the issue of fracking, but we also work on a number of food issues and, believe that the only way that we're going to see the kind of long-term change we need is for people all over the country to join together to demand it. And so check out the website, foodandwaterwatch.org.
If people go to the website, will they be able to be referred to? Are there links to state organizations that have to do with opposing fracking, or is it something you would have to find on your own that way?
That tool does not exist on our website, mm-hmm. but I know there's an organization, coalition in New York called New Yorkers Against Fracking that has a list of all the organizations. There are over 200 organizations that are a part of that coalition, so that might be a good place to start if you go to nyagainstfracking.org.
Mm-hmm. Generally, as far as the water supply goes, when they're injecting this stuff, and I mean, there are something called aquifers, right, where people get their mm-hmm. water from. I mean, these things are generally, I mean, with the, I think one of the problems with the XL pipeline, the people who oppose it said that it's going straight across or on top of one of the, maybe the largest aquifer. It's in the Midwest.
The Ogallala, yeah.
I mean, this fracking, is this affecting people's water in places that are not even right next to where it's happening, but, you know, even close to it?
I mean, there are cases of water contamination from drilling and fracking across the country. Yes, and mm-hmm. I think, you know, I think that the issues with water contamination are serious. There's growing body of research about the air quality issues near fracking wells, as well as the associated infrastructure, so the compressor stations and the other infrastructure that, you know, is part of this whole process of getting the gas from the ground and then distributing it into the systems where it runs into people's homes. And I think that the air quality issues are really serious, and where there's growing evidence of people having health effects and reporting the same health effects in different states across the country if they're living in close proximity to the fracking. But you know, air travels too. The air pollution, air contaminants can travel. And so the air quality in these regions where the drilling and fracking is happening is declining, and that's really concerning.
Can you give this is Emily Wirth from Food and Water Watch, and she's the head of she's the director of the water program. Just give the website address one more time.
Sure, it's www.foodandwaterwatch.org.
Okay, so if you're listening to these larger issues and you're worried about the state of your water and the air and the way this affects everybody, also if you don't want to have formaldehyde in your water and get embalmed before you're actually dead, you might actually want to go and check out Food and Water Watch, because this fracking is way out of control. I was sort of proud of New York the other day, you know, that the legislature did that. It was really something to see, you know. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. That was Emily Wirth from Food and Water Watch, and she's the water program director. I mean, really, it's just this is just one of those things. I mean, you know, it's banking, it's oil, it's you name it. But here we go again. The president has just appointed, and he'll have to go through the usual congressional ass kissing, which is otherwise known as a congressional grilling. I love how the newspapers call it a grilling, when in fact it's basically a honeymoon, you know, at a motel. Only you know you don't get to see the actual deed. So this guy will go in front. This is how extraordinary it gets to be now, and how it is in this country, right? The president is appointing a guy who is a professor at MIT, who wrote, along with a bunch of a team of people, this huge study about the effects of fracking on the air and the water, and came out and concluded that it wouldn't be so bad, and we really need the gas, you know, for our energy, and that the effects wouldn't be so bad. The effects are disastrous. The man is a liar. The man, but what's best about it is who paid for this study, and partially for him too, to make his way through life in a very comfortable way, is the very companies that are doing the drilling. Now, if this went to a court in any kind of decent place, like a city, I mean, a municipal court where they get hearings on, like, whether your dog, you know, did something on somebody else's lawn, any arbitrator or judge would say, you know, somebody would stand up and say, Your Honor, this man is testifying, but he's being paid by the people who he says aren't so bad. And the judge would say, okay, he's not a good witness. Out. You're out. But no, the higher you go, and this is, people have mentioned this before, if you steal a little bit, you're going to get caught and you're going to get beat up by the cops and you're going to throw you in jail. You know, you steal a tomato off somebody's, you know, store. You go in and, like, you know, grab a cell phone off a counter. They will beat the living daylights out of you and put you in jail for a year, right? But if you get to the point like GE, where you make $16 billion profit one year and you don't pay any taxes, which is basically stealing from all the rest of us, if you're that high up, then you get to be made the energy secretary. So this is the way it goes. Victor Hugo wrote Les Miserables, I think, in the 1850s, right, which is all about this kind of thing, or partially about that. It's about, there's nothing it isn't about. Nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. But America has really kind of perfected this. And what they've perfected is saying one thing and doing another thing. When it comes to hypocrisy, I don't believe that in the history of the world anybody has ever actually even approached the United States when it comes to hypocrisy. Talking about, for instance, you hear people talking about, you know, the strongest and most important democracy in the world. Not really. It isn't. It's not a democracy. And more specifically, the president will get on and say things like, we are fighting this war, name it, fill in the blank, Vietnam, you know, Afghanistan, Iraq, you know, whatever it is. Next it'll be Iran or it'll be in Colombia somewhere, some, whatever. We're fighting this war, or now it's going to be in the Congo. We're fighting this war to export the principles and the virtues and the blessings of democracy all over the world, right? No. That's not what they're fighting the war for, because there's no democracy at home here particularly anymore. And you can't export it at the end of a gun or by a cruise missile or by a drone strike. We're not exporting democracy. We're making the world safe for our corporations. And if there are some well-intentioned souls in the government, maybe in the State Department or somewhere, who really would like to see dictatorships be erased, they definitely got the wrong number if they're working for the United States government. And we are the specialists in assassinating democratically elected leaders all over the world. And, you know, one in Iran, for instance, where we're thinking of having a war right now. What was it, Biden the other day? Was beating the drums over at AIPAC, I think, about war in Iran. So basically, you've got this guy, Ernest Moniz, his name is, right? M-O-N-I-Z, an MIT professor. Check him out. Take a look. Go to Common Dreams, and I've mentioned Common Dreams before. Go to Common Dreams, Google it, and then just put in Moniz, M-O-N-I-Z, and you'll come up with this article probably. It's written by a staff member at Common Dreams called Joe, whose name is John Quealy, Q-U-E-L-L-Y. And it's just a short memo, but you'll find out more about this guy. He's probably on Wikipedia. The oil and gas industry pays for the study. This is what happens in pharmaceuticals all the time. Sometimes they're actually these days dismissing doctors, and they've even indicted a couple of doctors or fined them huge amounts of money. The pharmaceutical industry for dozens and dozens of years now has been paying doctors to do studies or to write reports in learned journals about how there's nothing wrong with this drug. And then they find out, you know, like 5 months or 2 years later that it's killed, you know, 100 people, or that it's caused developmental diseases and maybe, you know, 10,000 other people. And they find out that the doctor did a report and was paid by the very people who make this poison that the doctor said was just fine. This guy Moniz is one of these people. It's a hopeless situation. And what Emily Worth was saying before is where it's at. You have to get out on the street. She was one of 50,000 people. And that's just hopefully the beginning that demonstrated in front of the White House the other day, and a lot of people were arrested. It's the only way, as I've mentioned many times on this show, I don't see voting working at all anymore. I mean, what are your alternatives when you vote? At the lowest levels, maybe, and I'm talking about maybe in municipal cases of municipalities, or possibly in some state legislatures, it can make a difference. But on a national level, the alternative has got to be a third party. And people, you know, who say that, you know, a third party is a waste of your vote, you keep saying that and it just keeps coming true because you say that. Enough people keep voting for these third parties, they're going to have to pay attention because it's going to pull the parties over to one direction or another. Look what happened with the Tea Party. So this president is a total sellout. He's a corporate stooge. And he just recently gave his blessing to the XL pipeline. Which, by the way, I love this thing with the XL pipeline. The Republicans and a lot of Democrats saying it's going to provide jobs and America needs jobs. Yeah, it's going to provide between 6,000 and 10,000 jobs. That's a good number of jobs. And some people will, you know, their families will benefit and these people will get paid a lot of money to build and maintain the pipeline. It isn't even maintained that well, even after they build it. So 6,000 to 10,000 jobs. However, for 6,000 to 10,000 jobs for Americans, you're going to get what James Hansen, who is at NASA and is probably the leading climate scientist in this country, maybe in the world, one in the world, said that the tar sands, the oil tar sands, where this comes from in northern Canada, this is the worst, or next to the worst, or just about as bad as any kind of material that produces oil in the entire world. It's going to produce more pollution. The extraction of it and the use of it produces, and the refining of it produces more pollution than any other kind of oil. I mean, there's one, I think there's some in Venezuela that's pretty bad too. But this is the worst, this huge pool of oil tar sands up in Canada. So this is what the XL pipeline is. The Canada wants to produce this stuff and send it to the rest of the world and, you know, make money. And when I say Canada, I mean some, you know, oil company that's bribed the government to let them produce. And the government will get some royalties. Not near enough, of course. So this oil is is going to come from Canada in a huge pipeline all the way from northern Canada straight down to Texas, to the ports in Texas in the Caribbean. And what's going to happen is, in the Gulf of Mexico, rather, it's going to come straight down there. Nobody is going to, I mean, and this is, you know, not that we need more oil, exports, or anything like that. But this oil, this terrible stuff, right, which is causing pollution all over the place, is going to be in this giant pipeline coming straight down through America. It's going to be exported to the rest of the world. So we don't even, as if we knew, we don't even get the use of this oil, right? But the leaks could be, there's already been leaks in this oil pipeline, and just up in Canada and a couple of other places where there are pipelines built with this kind of oil tar sand. These leaks, if they're bad or even medium, can affect the hugest aquifer for water in the entire central and north central United States. It could destroy the water that's used by tens of millions of people. And in anywhere along the line, if it breaks or something happens, it can destroy water for God knows how many years. And it's going to cause the worst sort of pollution. So the president approves of this. And then he appoints this guy who is the fracking cheerleader, who approves of fracking. Did you vote for this president? Are we finally together? Are we on the same page with this guy? You can't vote for these people anymore. You cannot vote for a Democrat or a Republican. It's the same thing. It is the same thing. Yes, they throw a bone to various people, to women, to gays, to this, to that, and these are essential, vital, important things. I'm saying, throwing a bone is diminishing what they do. It's important. And yet, the bottom line, I mean, after all, if women's lot is improved, if it's better for gays in the United States because the Democrats get elected, it's still worse for all of us. You're gay, you're a woman, you're a man, you're straight. It doesn't matter who you are, whatever color you are. You're still going to be breathing poison air. You're still going to get cheated by banks. Prices of everything will go up and you'll be, practically starving. You won't have a house to live in. It doesn't matter who you are or what you are. Yeah, you'll have more rights to do this, that, and the other thing. But still, the basic qualities of your life, the same as anybody else, are going to be destroyed by his behavior and by his allowing corporations to run amok. So the newest one is Ernest Moniz to be the energy professor, head of the energy department. So we're going to take a little break now, and we'll be back in a little bit. Don't forget to check with Occupied Territory, the Facebook page. Go there, and there's constant activity going on there, and I'd be interested to hear your opinion about that. Okay. Okay, we're back. This is Occupied Territory with Mike Fader. And interesting. The Occupy movement appears to have disappeared entirely. Not true. There are, and I'm going to give you some information. I'm going to post this on the Occupied Territory Facebook page. There is a growing number of radio stations in this country. The once upon a time radio network, the Pacifica network that had WBAI in New York, that has WBAI in New York for however many weeks it's left to live, and that had a few stations in California, and that two stations in California, one in Houston and one in Washington, they were at the forefront. This was true radical, anti-capitalist, left-wing radio with brilliant people, information that you really needed, available nowhere else, right, at all. And this was big in the 60s and 70s, and even a little bit into the 80s. It declined for various reasons. And there's millions of other kinds of radio now. But there is an up-and-coming group of radio stations in this country, small terrestrial radio stations, internet radio stations, and podcast places that are dedicated, absolutely dedicated, to alternative ways of achieving things outside political parties. And there are networks of places, and I will list them as I get increasing information on the Occupied Territory Facebook page, where you can tune in and hear these things on the net or in local areas. You can tune in live and hear real radio, you know, live people, which is always better than podcasts as far as I'm concerned, to hear live radio in your area, local live radio. And these places are all about alternatives, co-ops, organizing, co-ops, co-op banks, ways to avoid the overwhelmingly locked-in conspiratorial political and capitalist system. There's ways to do this. And there are, so there's a new Pacifica network out there, and it's developing on its own. It's not so organized, and in some ways that's even better that it's not so organized. And look to that. Look to that. It's happening more all the time. What else? Some interesting things. As far as now, obviously, you all read about and know about the fact that Hugo Chavez died just the other day. I think it was this past Tuesday. And there's an article post that I posted by Greg Palast, investigative journalist Greg Palast, just about as good as it gets when it comes to investigative journalism. There's an article that he wrote on his website about Hugo Chavez, who he interviewed many, many times, and who he got some information from, that when other national American media organizations, of course, were either ignoring him. How does this sound familiar? They were either ignoring him or denouncing him as an anti-American terrorist, a communist, and whatever else that they make up before they interview Lindsay Lohan on their show. So Greg Palast is going to be here next Thursday on Occupied Territory at 11 a.m. I'm sorry, at 2 p.m. To talk about Hugo Chavez. Now, he visited with him. Hugo Chavez is a fascinating character. A lot of good, a lot of bad. You know, one of these guys who's an unusual, you know, one in a million, one in 10 million, person who slept 2 hours a night, a kind of a genius. And he grew up, and you know, basically from Indian stock down in Venezuela. Like in Central America, Mexico and Central America and South America, without going into a whole anthropological, historical overview here, is essentially it has to do with a kind of racial thing and where you're from. The colonial conquerors, the imperialists, the, you know, the great murderers and enslavers from Europe, and a lot of them Spanish or some from Portugal and some, a lot of them from Spain, took over these areas, right? Invaded in the 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, took over and enslaved these areas and became the owners of all this land and all the resources. Later on, they cooperate with, and then, of course, there's intermarrying, right? And so it works down there that if you, you know, if you were from Spain, if you're lighter skinned, if you're, you know, taller, in other words, if you're not literally an Indian or of Indian stock down all the way from Mexico straight down to the bottom of South America, it's all a matter of class. It's all a matter of class. So the rulers of Venezuela, like the rulers of almost every other country in Central America and South America, were of this kind of, you know, of this racial sort of high, quote unquote, racial stock. And they always, they spent all their time, and this is like 10 to 20% of the population. The rest of the people, roughly between, let's say, 70 and 80% of the population in any of these countries, and it was this way in Venezuela, are Indians. Exploited beyond description, right, for hundreds of years. And if they had any trouble down there, these dictators and the corporations, United States corporations that, like United Fruit, ITT, International Telephone and Telegraph, and other large corporations, you know, the sugar corporations, oil and gas corporations, Chevron and other places. You go down there, and this has been going on for like 100 years. If there's any trouble with these dictators down there and their police and their armies who are vicious to these native populations originally, who are the mass of people down there, any trouble about how they didn't want to be enslaved or treated like serfs or have like, you know, 2 feet of land while somebody who is descended from some grandee from Spain has, you know, 100,000 acres of land that they don't even use or makes money from and just sells it overseas. if you're upset about this and you wanted to take back your own land and you wanted to get something more than, you know, just to live in a shack that dripped at night and protect your children or even send them to school and get them, you know, some education, then they would send the United States would send the United States Marines in, or they would get the secret police of these countries, you know, trained at someplace like Fort Benning, the School of the Americas. They would train them how to torture people. That's what the United States did for all in all these decades. Sometimes people write to me and they say, you know, you hate America so much, or you're so anti-American. No. It just upsets me. The truth of our history, of our real history, upsets me no end. It makes me angry and it makes me sad. And I feel like it needs mentioning all the time because people don't know it. Either they don't care or they don't get taught this stuff in school. And certainly you will never see it on the news, because this country has time and time again, and just decade after decade, starting in the 20s, we sent Marines into Nicaragua. We sent people into Haiti, Marines into Haiti in the 20s and 30s. Certainly, we've sent troops into the Dominican Republic. We tried to assassinate Castro. Certainly, we tried to invade, Cuba, the Bay of Pigs in 1962, I think it was, or 61. This never stops. And, of course, the United States government tried to assassinate Chavez. And when they're trying to assassinate Chavez, they actually literally, along with some corporate help, it's like the big corporations, United Fruit, Chevron, other places like this, taking all the natural resources from these places, cooperating with these landed racist gentry and the church, of course. You always got to remember the church, the Catholic Church, right in there with the Inquisition and palling up with these dictatorships every single time down the line. Once in a while in the last 40, 50 years in places like this, the church showed that they actually vaguely and distantly remembered what Jesus was here for in the first place. And some of the priests, and occasionally like Romero, some of these bishops and some of the monsignors said, wait a minute, this is not the way it's supposed to be. Our movement, the movement that represents Jesus Christ down here, shouldn't be aligned with dictators and the United Fruit Company and Chevron and torture and murder and locking everybody up and causing mass poverty. We should be fighting these things. We are here for the people. We are here for the poor, just like the original man said. And these people were really locked up and attacked and assassinated by the combination of the higher orders of the church, the dictators in the United States government. Now, the CIA has been agitating in all these countries for a long time. There were numerous assassination attempts on Chavez, originated from the United States. George Bush, in 2002, actually said it. And at one point, Chavez was literally kidnapped and held for, I think it was at least 2 days. Maybe I think it was on an island in the Caribbean. You can check this out on Greg Palast's article that I posted on Occupied Territory. He was kidnapped by the American government. And Bush came out and said, yeah, we are trying to remove him. And numerous attacks on Chavez in the press, from the media down in Venezuela. And of course, you know, there's supposed to be a democracy. I mean, he tried a coup once. I'm not sure, you know, it was probably sort of a semi-dictatorship. Chavez himself was not averse to coups. He knew he was denouncing coups. These people are a combination. They're extreme individuals. And he saw himself as kind of, not a dictator, but a supreme leader. And he didn't like to be questioned. He was a brilliant man, Chavez. Didn't have that much education. Came up and, through poverty and entered the military academy. And, joined the army. Became an army officer later on. And was in charge of actually his first, you know, active job in the field was to quell insurgents in Venezuela. And finally, he flipped over to the other side. But he comes from these people. So all the 80% of Venezuela's population is from this Indian, you know, background, this Indian stock, this native stock. And they're the ones who were kept abysmally poor and oppressed, got no education, tortured and arrested by the cops all the time and by the national police. So he tried to lead a coup. I think it was in 1992. It didn't work. He got locked up for a while and came out and, you know, took advantage of what there was of democracy there and finally built up a political party and won. But he was not kind to people, to put it mildly, who opposed him. And that's complicated because people who ran against him, newspapers that published articles against him, street demonstrations that were organized against him, a lot of this was legitimate because crime went up a lot. I don't know what the problem was down there, and I guess there'll be books written about it, and you'll hear more about it from me when I learn about it. But crime went up a lot. Street crime and other kinds of crime went up down there. What he did do that was important, that's the most important thing, and this occurs spasmodically throughout Mexico, Central America, and South America for the last 100 years, and usually the Marines are sent in, or the native police, or you know, the government police, or the soldiers in these places put down these movements brutally, murdering tens of thousands of people, like Pinochet, you know. What happens is there are two major things. Resources like, you know, fruit, vegetables, and oil, you know, in Venezuela. Massive, huge, conglomerations of companies, corporate entities, steal this stuff. They just come in there. They treat people like slaves. They beat people. They're in league with the police. And they just steal this stuff. They pay people nothing. People are arrested or beaten up or killed if they object to it. And they steal these natural resources. In Venezuela, Chevron and a couple of other companies, but particularly Chevron, for dozens and dozens of years was down there taking oil out of Venezuela and paying some pitiful royalty, basically a large off-to-the-side Swiss bank account, cash bribe to whoever was running this country and same in other countries, and taking a huge amount of money, paying almost no royalties at all to the government. So taking us like pure profit, just taking this stuff, and the Venezuelans en masse are poverty-stricken, right? No way it should be this way. Chavez gets in there, and he says, guess what? I'm changing the royalty for something like whatever it was, 2% to 30%. You want to get oil and gas from this place? You can't just take it out and steal from us. You got to pay for it for a change. And these companies were appalled, shocked, went and complained, you know, like little whiny babies to the American government. And they said, sure, we'll help you out. We'll use the CIA. All of which is to say that a lot of demonstrations against Chavez, a lot of the publicity in the national media down in Venezuela, a lot of the political organizing was funded and was provoked and instigated by the United States of America, in an underground way. And sometimes they just came out and said it. Chavez came to the UN shortly after Bush, admitted that he was trying to kill Chavez and take back the government for the corporations. He came to the UN, Chavez, and called Bush the devil. But sometimes people get it right. And of course, he got a little wrong. Actually, it's Cheney who's the devil. Bush is just a clown. But, Chavez, he just put it in people's faces. So it's two major things, like I was saying before. One is to get back these natural resources, or to at least make these giant international corporations pay for the privilege of taking it out of the land that they get it from, right? Second thing is land redistribution. In some of these countries, like in Venezuela and several other of these countries, there are, you know, maybe 100 or 200 huge families, interconnected, sort of like royalty or monarchy families that own 80, 70, 80, 90% of the land in these countries. And it's not this way now because it's been redistributed a lot. Chavez comes in and grabs back millions of acres of land that's been unused or used solely for the enrichment of certain families in this country for generations and redistributes it to people who had nothing for hundreds of years. And for that, he is a great hero down there. The standard of living went way up for people. They finally had land to work. They didn't have to be slaves and peons for some huge corporations and landed gentry. And they loved him for that down there. He was one of them. And that's why they loved him so much. So, but there was legitimate reaction against him because he was dictatorial. He was not fond of, because he suspected, and because he was right in some cases, but because he suspected that a lot of the newspaper editorials and newspaper articles against him, the street demonstrations, the political parties, because he suspected the opposition was entirely provoked by outside influences, i.e., you know, the CIA in the United States and corporations, American corporations, he suppressed a lot of this stuff. He was not a fan of democracy. He was one of these people. I'm the boss. You know, I've done all these great things for you, which he did. How dare you question me? Just shut up and do what I tell you to do. There's a lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people left Venezuela since he took over. And I don't know how long that's been, 12 years now that he was in charge. A lot of people left there. Now, who was it that left? We'll find out from Greg Palast next Thursday. Probably a lot of people, and it's just like Castro in Cuba. When he came in and took over, the main people that left and who cooperated with the CIA and the American government to overthrow him the most were the people who had the most money. This was the landed gentry, the people who owned big businesses, the people who managed places for U.S. corporations and the mafia. This is who got the most upset and continued to be that way. Down in Florida, now finally, older Cubans in Florida don't have as much power. They're dying off, and there's a new generation of Cubans in Florida that don't understand and don't agree that Castro should be the devil. And this is what's happening. They don't feel the same way as their grandparents and great-grandparents did. So this is what's happening. In Venezuela, same old thing. So crime went way up, which was out of control. I don't know what the situation was there. A lot of people left just because of crime. There were kidnappings, muggings. People were not safe. And a lot of people left. There's disagreement about what that... It was generally people in the upper class. But professional classes, a lot of decent people left because they couldn't exist down there because of the crime. I don't know why it was out of control, but it was. Also, if you wanted complete freedom of speech, Venezuela was not a great place to be. I mean, this guy just did not like people disagreeing with him. And I'm not sure how many people he threw in jail, but he certainly made it very difficult to express your opinion if it was against his. So he's a mixture of things, Chavez, a very interesting character. And a lot of the people who grow up in very extreme societies like this, where they're not used to democracy, wind up, you know, even people who want to redistribute the land and don't want corporations to loot and rape, which is certainly the most important thing of all, to actually help the mass of people, like in this country, it'd be nice if we had somebody like that, not a Democrat or Republican. These people tend to be a certain kind of personality. I mean, they risk their lives. They get thrown in jail, like Castro. People try to kill them. And after a while, they get an attitude, right? Now, I'm not excusing their excesses, right? Castro's police and Castro's national police in Cuba and his attitude towards expression, freedom of speech, and political opposition is notorious, right? I mean, this guy was a brutal dictator. At the same time that he raises the literacy rate of Cuba to the point where it's better than the United States and most other countries, where he redistributes land, where he makes it easier to run a business, where especially he provides some of the best free health care in the entire world, so much, trained so many doctors in specialties in general medicine that they actually went all over the place into Africa and other Latin American countries to help people. And to this day, Americans, if you watched Sicko, Michael Moore's Sicko, you see that some people in this country who couldn't get treatment because they couldn't afford it or it wasn't available went down to Cuba to be treated. So he did a tremendous amount for the people of Cuba. On the other hand, if you didn't like what he's saying and you said it out loud, you could get killed, thrown in jail for 20 years, and there was no newspapers attacking him. There's no political parties opposing him. This is what you get sometimes down there. It's a very, very delicate balance. And Chavez had these tendencies, and he acted this way. An interesting character. So that's next week. We'll talk to Greg Palast more about that. But in other countries around there, in Bolivia and Uruguay and Ecuador and other countries, Chavez's influence spread. Chavez made so much money for his government And he was another thing about Chavez. These guys, they like to take care of themselves. They come from poverty. He flew around in a gigantic plane, like Air Force One, just to take little trips here and there. It wasn't state business, right? He took care of himself and his family very well. Same old stuff, right? Same old stuff. You have to watch people, right? He may have been a man of the people, but you got to watch people like this all the time because they get carried away with themselves. So he had so much money from oil revenue, you know, which he took back from these rapacious American oil corporations, that he financed a lot of political, socialist and democratic political movements in other Latin American countries. And he hated America so much for good reason. For good reason and for just and righteous reasons. He hated America and what it stood for and in other countries. He didn't hate democracy or you and me. He hated America as it was represented in his country and all over the world. Guns and bribery massive suppression, support of dictators and invasions and occupations and the CIA trying to assassinate people. He hated America, and he had every right to, like most of the rest of the world does, sadly, my country. He hated America, and what he would sometimes it would carry him to extremes. He would go off and, you know, kiss cheeks and shake hands with every nasty dictator in the world, right? It didn't matter what their point of view was in any other way or what they were like to their own people. If they hated America, that was okay with him. And now he's gone. We can just imagine what's going on in the CIA and the State Department right now and in the military. You could just imagine. Just the other day, Chavez's government, just before he died, this guy named Maduro, who is his appointee to take over, and we'll see what happens. They threw out two United States military attaches and accused them of provoking, a coup against the government. Yeah, you think so? Probably. I could throw out the entire embassy. It's probably one big CIA outpost. So we can only imagine what's going to happen in the next several weeks and couple of months. They will try to have orderly elections down there, but we'll see what our CIA does. How do you like it that our government murders people over the world, assassinates democratic elected leaders, assists corporations and keep people at serf and slave wages, and you have nothing to say about it? You just show up every 2 years and 4 years and cast your vote and shut your mouth. God bless America.